You're listening to Green Mountain Medicine, an original podcast series by ACP Vermont for all things internal medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And we're your hosts.
This series aims to unpack the complexity of medicine in a nuanced and evidence-based way. We invite you to relax, grab some coffee, maybe some tea, maybe you're just a water person, and engage with us as we discuss the topics that impact our fields and characterize our practice.
Today we have Dr. Pearson, and Dr. Pearson was hired as clinical faculty at the University of Vermont College of Medicine and the University of Vermont Medical Group within the Division of Dermatology in 2013. He also serves as the Residency Program Director of Dermatology. Prior to this position, he completed 20 years of active duty service in the U.S. Army Medical Corps, and Dr. Pearson previously served as the Vice Chair for Faculty Development for the Department of Medicine, but relinquished that role after also being named interim chief for the dermatology division last fall. And now he is joining us to speak about his impressive life. So, Dr. Pearson, what made you want to become a dermatologist, and what personality traits do you feel makes a good dermatologist?
You know, I would have been voted least likely to enter dermatology when I was in medical school. I absolutely had no interest whatsoever in going into it. And I was at a military hospital where they farmed us out after the second year of medical school. And what they did in the emergency room on slow days, they said none of them knew anything about dermatology. And they had this young buck dermatologist, fresh out of Walter Reed, who loved teaching people. So on slow days, I would wander over there with him. And he ended up becoming a quite famous dermatologist who's now in South Carolina at MUSC. But in any event, at the end of that summer, I still was not convinced I'd be a dermatologist. But over time, as I went and did my rotations in medical school, I realized I had a unique skill set and kind of liked it. But it was quite accidental in terms of how I landed in dermatology that way.
What about doing your rotations in dermatology really drove you to want to pursue that?
You know what? I would say that on any given day, there was at least one significant diagnostic or therapeutic challenge, which was a lot of fun. So, you know, there are a number of rare disorders in dermatology, but there's also significant therapeutic challenges and surgical challenges, and it ended up being far funner than I expected it to be. There's many different types of dermatologists out there. People who are drawn to attention to detail type fields certainly will go into dermatology, but there's many, many different personality types, and there's many different subspecialties within dermatology that reflect that, such as dermatopathology, where it is one of the few fields certified in pathology as a dermatologist by doing a dermatopathology fellowship. And then you have those who are more significantly procedural oriented, who can go into Mohs surgery, which is an additional year fellowship, just like dermatopathology. And we have good fellowships in both dermatopathology and Mohs surgery here at the medical center. And then lastly, a newer subspecialty within dermatology is pediatric dermatology. And we're blessed to have a fantastic pediatric dermatologist with us. But those who migrate more towards taking kids can specialize in that also. So many different types of personalities. And there's certainly research tracks people can go into. We are not a very focused cosmetic center, but there are people who enter cosmetic realms of dermatology. Certainly with my military background, I didn't have much chance to get my skills honed in that area. But those are just some examples of the various paths one can follow in dermatology.
Well, thanks so much for sharing. And it's really interesting to hear about how vast the world of dermatology is. So I'm sure our viewers will really appreciate that. And I definitely learned something as well. So our next question for you is about your background, since it seems like you have a particularly interesting one, having been in the Army and having had volunteered for overseas tours. Could you tell us a bit about what got you interested originally in serving and how these experiences have made you a better physician?
Well, you know, I am the ninth of 10 children. In fact, my parents had 10 kids by the time they were 29 or 30 years old. So there was not a lot of money to go to school. So to answer the question, I was an indentured servant. So I didn't get any football scholarship offers. So the military paid for college, and then progressed to medical school. And likewise, the military picked up the tab for medical school. So you entered as an indentured servant, and I enjoyed the team atmosphere. I saw that many people in the military just genuinely wanted to do good, and ended up having a great experience with it. Because they paid for so much of my schooling, I owed them a long period of time. And then my commitment to the military was finishing up right around the time that 9/11 occurred. And I was stationed at West Point, New York. And right after the bombings, I went down there and found myself on those mountains of debris with buckets searching for survivors. And at that point in time, even though my commitment was done, I elected to stay on and served another 10 years plus after that. So just drawn to the people, drawn to trying to serve the greater good, and just a love of country. And that's what amounted to my military career.
That's amazing. Thanks for sharing. And I think the military and being in medicine kind of have overlying passion. And at the base of both of them is, you know, being a very noble person. So I can definitely see how you would fit well in both roles.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I'm also wondering, you have 9 siblings, right? How were the family dinners? Was it just you running to the table to try and get the food first? How did they feed everyone?
I'm probably a fast eater out of a reflection for of that with all the older siblings, but yeah, it's a miracle looking back on it.
That is so wild.
You could run that sort of operation, but you know, by the time I came along and my kid brother came along, who's also a physician, I will say that my older siblings became like additional parents. And mm-hmm. I was probably more afraid of doing things that got me into trouble for my older siblings than my parents sometimes, because they were pretty tough on us. But they, in the end, it was great having those older siblings who helped guide us in so many ways in life and in education.
That's so nice. So we've heard that you have many hobbies and, like you just said, spending time with your family, but also running marathons, and you've completed 15 marathons. So one thing is, what do you listen to for 26.2 miles? And what's the drive to do these marathons?
Yeah, I hate to brag, but when I say I'm a big runner, it's because I weigh about 200 pounds. That's the way I'm a big runner. But it's evolved since I was a teenager into more of a mental health benefit. And I actually don't listen to any music. So I know a lot of people do, but just memories from the lifetime just come through you when you're running. And I tend to work through some issues with regards to work, challenges in life in general while I'm running. It's just a nice time for introspection and reflection, and that's the greatest benefit for me. But sometimes I'll be out for a number of miles, and it just goes by, and I lose sense of time. So it's to answer your question, it's mostly about the relaxation. I've stepped away from the extreme running here over the last 10 years or so, but still run regularly, and my wife and I do shorter runs now. She did her first half marathon last year. So
I was
there with her for that.
Wow. That's really nice, because I feel like you don't really think of this, of how running is therapeutic, but when you're alone in your own thoughts, it can be. So that's really nice to hear. And congratulations to your wife.
thanks for saying that.
Do you feel like you've kind of dove into nature at all on your runs? Like, do you listen to bird sounds? Do you have any other external stimulus?
I just take it all in, and it's just after I'm out there for a couple minutes, I just get absorbed in the atmosphere, and I always feel more relaxed when I come back from a run.
So we read that you completed your residency at the Cleveland Clinic Foundation in dermatology. Could you share with us more about your intern year, and what was the biggest learning curve that you experienced?
So, you know, the biggest learning curve is still the one to this day, and that's just consolidating a lot of information that patients throw at you into an appropriate framework for the encounter. So it was a challenge in medical school. It was a challenge in internship. And here at the age of 60, it's still a challenge. that you're going to continually try to refine. But that was probably the biggest, is just taking a patient's history that is oftentimes very, very complex at a tertiary care center like that. But I will say, I felt just as you should, coming from the University of Vermont, my medical school that was relatively new back in Youngstown, Ohio, I had a great time there and was able to do a number of internal medicine rotations, a medicine sub-internship. And I remember certain things said to me back then that I use to this day and that I still teach. And one of them is just having respect for medications in general. And on a hemoc rotation one medical school, at the time I thought it was a little harsh, but my hemoc attending, who was excellent back in medical school, used to say, what poisons is the patient currently on? And he did that to have us develop an appreciation of the fact that these medications have a number of side effects. And to this day, you just have to respect those. You can't be afraid of the medications, but developing a sense for what can go wrong in terms of side effects and interactions, I think was instilled back in medical school and continued during internship also, in terms of just having respect to with the whole continuum of the medication management spectrum.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective to look at, because I feel like we always, I mean, at least for me, I've always grown up being like, oh, you have all these medications that can fix problems, but they also can create other ones. So it's a really interesting perspective.
And I agree about the medications. I think that's a great rule of thumb. And I'm glad that you shared that, Pearl, with us, because I feel like so often in medicine, we see patients who are on oodles and oodles of medication and just kind of becomes our norm. I remember working as an EMT for a few years. I used to do a lot of calls at nursing homes, and the patients print out, like, their demographic sheet would have like 40 medications on it. And, you know, we'd all flip through it like it was normal and, you know, without much care to the side effects. So I appreciate your perspective.
Yeah. And aside from your own clinical experience, you also do a lot of teaching. And for our audience members, Dr. Pearson taught many of our dermatology lectures in a course called Connections for the second year med students. And he bestowed upon us wonderful pieces of advice. I believe it was the first class that we had in dermatology. And I was just wondering, Dr. Pearson, if you can share those 5 mentoring tips with the audience.
I can certainly share those 5 tips. And then I scratched down 5 more bonus tips because of the podcast here today. So,
oh, wow. That, special. Yeah. Inside look.
We're in for a treat.
No. But what I've been encouraging the students, because we start off the second year medical school for you folks, and just want you to have some big picture perspectives. And you know, over the 30 years since I finished residency, the first lesson I tell all students is don't be afraid to be wrong. And that's quite critical. And just see that people tighten up when they're in constant fear of making a mistake, and actually see that it hurts their learning. And that's what you hear, is to learn. And I had actually seen a quote related to the don't be afraid to be wrong. And one of my military colleagues that said, the greatest mistake you can make in life is to be continually fearing you will make one. And you can't live like that. I always use sports analogies also, but it's kind of like when someone's afraid to lose versus playing to win. So you think positive and you just go as best you can, but it'll make you tight, and it'll actually perhaps not leave your mind open to figuring things out, which was what all of us will do in our medical careers. You have to evolve from that mindset of pre-med of trying to always have the exact right answer to being much more of a problem solver. So that's it. The first one, don't be afraid to be wrong. And the second one was learn from everyone around you. And you just want to be very egalitarian in that regard. And if you just keep your mind open, it's not a top-down phenomenon in terms of how you learn. You'll have underclassmen who will be saying things, and they may say something to you that could be life-transforming. So So learn from everyone around you. And then number three was listen to everyone, but follow no one. And over the years, I've seen people just follow someone like a Pied Piper and always repeat exactly what one person is saying. But you just want to listen to everyone and get a gestalt that works for you, because no human being has all the right answers. But again, listen to everyone, but follow no one. Number four is embrace everything you do in medical school. Embrace all the disciplines in medical school. And you know, some people enter medical school and have a firm mind in terms of what they want to do, but it'll make you a better physician, even if you still end up doing what you set out to do when you started medical school. If you embrace everything and at least reflect on possibly doing that for a living, I think you owe it to yourself to think that way. And I certainly stumbled into something that I did for a career that I had absolutely zero interest in doing. And then number five, appreciate the nuances of really liking a mentor versus really liking a specialty. And that's just more as people go through their rotations over the years. I've seen students who will migrate to certain personalities, which we do in life. But then they lean more on that than they do on the discipline that they're working in. And you got to step away from that person and reflect on whether it's that person who's drawing you towards that discipline, or is it the discipline themselves? And many times they do overlap and in sync, but not always. So you owe it to yourself to sit back and reflect on you doing that, as opposed to always having that mentoring or inspiring figure around you. I scratched down a few things that I spoke about at a graduation one time back in the 1990s. If you indulge me for a couple more minutes, the one sign, it was in my high school football locker room, but I still remember it to this day, and that's: form good habits, they're harder to break than bad ones. Well, that's number six. Number seven actually comes from Colin Powell, who used to be the old chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but he had these 10 rules of success, and his one of his recommendations for success was get mad, then get over it. And for many of us, you're going to get mad, and there's no two ways about it. But you have to forgive yourself for doing that, and just get over it and move on. But to think you're never going to get mad is almost inhuman for some of us. But related to that is something that I try to live by, and that's the best apologies are those able to go unspoken. So we're going to do things we regret, and you can apologize verbally or in writing, and you do that. But over time, if you have the opportunity, and sometimes we don't, but if you have the opportunity, just by your actions, really showing people that you're sorry for whatever you did, in the long run is the best way to make up for anything. Both in your professional lives and your personal lives. Something I learned when I was a pre-med student back in Youngstown, one of the physicians at a hospital used to constantly say that all that is new is not good, and all that is old is not bad. And we have so many new developments that come down the pike. Not all of them are going to gain traction and really be that beneficial, and never lose sight of some of the older things that we do in medicine that actually still are quite valuable. And then lastly, I just remember this when I was entering junior high, as the 10th one. And that was just the notion of turning a page in life and realizing we can turn those pages at any point in time on any given day. As you guys will be in transition as you go through medical school, going from year to year and then going on to your internships. But if you want to rededicate yourself to self-improvement or transforming yourself, you can do that at any point in time. So I just remember the way it was delivered, which was much more eloquently than I am doing. But someone saying that just to turn that next page, it's a blank slate. And we have that opportunity at any point in time to do that. So thanks. Those are the full 10 bits of advice this old man has for you guys.
Katie, I hope you're writing those down.
Writing them down as you speak. I'm gonna need you to repeat all 6 through 10 one more time. No, but I really I love hearing those. I have like a little Tips for Happiness book, which honestly I'm a little embarrassed about admitting. But it's a lot of the self-improvement. You can do that at any age. And I feel like people feel like, oh, I'm now 25. Like I've set up to do this and this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. But you can, like, even with your life, like you've navigated so many different types of career paths and then you've ended up here. And it's just, yeah, I think you can change any time of your life, which is really nice to hear.
Okay, so for our next question, I know that you said that you haven't really dabbled in the cosmetic side of dermatology too much, but as a dermatologist, we are curious to know your skincare routine. And also, what's all the rage right now is people refrigerating their skincare products. So we wanted to know if you think this has any merit.
You know what? It's funny. What's all the rage and what I hear about in the office? I actually have not had any person say anything about refrigerating products, just because I'm sure they the non-cosmetic dermatologist. But there is some science behind that. I'll tell you, we actually even have some medications that we tell people to refrigerate. One of our eczema medications, for example, called tacrolimus, can sting and burn, and that's somewhat reduced when they chill the medicine. And then there's some science behind the viability of medications being in a refrigerator sometimes. But to answer your question, I don't give any special guidance that way. Maybe you can tell me about it so I can start incorporating that into my visits.
I don't, maybe it's just Katie and I after all.
It's really big on like a social media platform because I feel like, well, I guess that's also another problem where you're getting your advice from non-professionals. But I'm just curious though, can regular soap and water, is that fine?
Yeah, well, that's all I do. I actually don't have much of a, I don't have any routine at all. I would say that the biggest thing is just limiting your sun exposure. And I am very, very fond of telling people we want them to enjoy life to their fullest. Whatever they like doing outdoors, whatever your passion is, please continue doing it. But if you just navigate your outdoor activities, if you have the opportunity, if you navigate activities early in the morning and later in the afternoon, evening makes a huge difference. It's that peak midday sun that really gets us. And if you're out in that sun during those hours, short of sunscreen, you can put sunscreen on the back burner. But being in the shade as best you can, wearing clothing, covering you as much as practical, wearing a wide-brimmed hat. If you do those things alone, it makes a huge, huge difference. But by all means, want people to enjoy all the stuff they're like doing. And but if they have exposed skin during those peak hours, it makes a huge difference when people are protecting their sun. You'd be surprised as you see some of these patients in their 60s and 70s who started doing this decades ago, the ones who did that versus the ones who don't always look about 10 or 20 years younger from a cosmetic standpoint. And then obviously it's going to reduce the risk of certain skin cancers.
Mm-hmm. I'm just picturing you running your marathon in a bucket hat and the whole time and just holding on to it. So it doesn't fly away.
If you guys can find a perfect sunscreen that doesn't burn your eyes a little bit, I just remember wiping my eyes as I'm sweating, even with the waterproof, sweatproof products. That's a tough issue, but no, those marathons are always early in the morning. So we're not out there running it at noon.
You're if right. It were me, I'd be finishing at like 6 p.m. But for you'll be done sooner than me.
Yeah, Haley's very safe from the sun by the time she's finishing that race. So switching gears a bit, we know that you love to read. And one of your favorite books is The Laws of Simplicity. And we are just curious, why is this your favorite book?
You know, The Laws of Simplicity was on some bestseller lists about a decade or so when it came out. But I am the biggest fan and the biggest supporter of that book because I have not opened the cover. And it is one of those, you get it with the title, right? And I'm the first person who just makes a huge deal about how we have become a bit too complex. And I think we need to make a conscious effort to sit back and simplify as frequently as we can. We are no smarter as humans than we were tens of thousands of years ago, right? But there's so much background noise that sometimes we lose focus. And I fear that. And I fear that for society in general, but specifically in the realm of medicine. You know, when you turn on some of these electronic health records, there's so much data that's on a screen. And there's that the art of being able to focus is tougher with all this technology that we have sometimes. So it's certainly a double-edged sword, as you're aware. I mean, I'm glad we have so much of the technology that we do, but we got to take a step back every now and then. So to answer your question, that was just a little joke there to say I'm the biggest fan of the book. I've never read the book, but I think it's great that someone pointed that out. Apparently this book gives some tips on how you can recapture simplicity within your life.
You read the title, so I think you read the book.
And I do know that it was an MIT professor, but surprise, surprise, he's never invited me on his speaking tour, and I don't receive any royalties for all these promotions that I'm doing for his book.
Oh my goodness, that's so funny.
That's hilarious. And I'm, you know, also not an owner of the book, I must admit, but I also read the title. So I guess that's getting me somewhere, right? Hopefully.
Exactly. Exactly.
It kind of reminds me of, I don't know if you've heard of them before, but they're called tiny homes. And it's like essentially people who want to simplify their life. They sell their larger home and they move into like, you know, we're talking like 150 square foot or less tiny home that has only the staples of what they need. So I wonder if that's in the book.
Exactly.
We'll be able to tell you, but
maybe one of our viewers might know. So we'll see what they say. So we wanted to know what the most challenging aspect of your specialty or just medicine in general is.
You know what? I would say the two things that I see as the biggest challenges right now for dermatology and medicine overall is just over-documentation. And that goes back to the laws of simplicity. There's just way, way too much information, and it can be pared down. So I'm a minimalist, and I think all of us need to strive to be minimalist as possible. So there's a lot of well-intentioned people out there who will insert additional verbiage that can be found on electronic health records. But in the end, that slows us down. And all that extra effort with regards to over-documentation, the note bloat phenomenon, it leads to burnout in medicine. So, but we all contribute to it to some degree. Now, certainly there's requirements for reimbursement with regards to documentation, but I think the pendulum has swung far too far with regards to documentation and all the information that's at hand. So, you know, getting to the bottom line, what are the most important nuggets, and then having a separate screen part where you can access some of this information. But we really need to make a conscious effort in medicine overall to avoid note bloat, and that will make all of our lives easier and should help us avoid burnout. And then the second phenomenon that the medicine is struggling to get their arms around is the access of health information that patients have, and then going on to these platforms of the MyChart phenomenon, where they can reach out whenever they'd like with regards to questions, and very, very well intentioned. And it's great to be able to help people with significant issues, but many providers, many clinicians are inundated with messages, and you know, some of these issues can be very, very routine. And I don't know where you draw the line, because nowadays, sometimes at the end of the day, you'll have a number of these messages that need to be addressed, and they're a challenge. So getting our arms around this MyChart access so that people can take good care of patients, but then also have a life and a work hard, play hard sort of fashion that I was brought up with. Those are the two biggest challenges.
Yeah, that's really an interesting point that you touch on with the patient access to the healthcare portals. And I think you brought up a great point that, you know, it's great for patients, although I imagine sometimes it can be scary when they're getting their reports before, you know, physicians are calling them with any lab results or other results. Absolutely. But, you know, it's also a drain, could be a drain on the physicians as well. And, you know, I imagine that could be hard with burnout. So great point that you make there.
Yeah, I was thinking also the point that you were making about documentation. Before medical school, I was an emergency medicine scribe at UVM, and my whole job was doing the documentation for the attendings. And it was really wild to me to think how I would watch these residents and they would go and see just as many patients as the attendings and then have to document all of their notes. And they were just there so late. And I was thinking, wow, this is what I'm signing up for. But no, it just, yeah, it was a little mind boggling to me. But
no, it's just, you guys are all smarter than my generation. And it's just getting our arms around the technology to make it work better. And hopefully you'll do that, but it takes conscious effort to make things simple. And Bill Gates is a gazillionaire because he took very complex issues and then he created these computers that you could open at a grandmother can be navigating the internet in the snap of the fingers. So people, if there were more Bill Gates-like folks in the information technology arena in medicine, I think we would have been better off years ago.
I think you have another piece of advice now. Just be Bill Gates.
Exactly.
Just add that to next year's list.
No, but on the final piece about the access that patients have, some institutions have started charging to have that access. So when you send these messages, there'd be a charge to try to limit it. Mm. But then that the consequence of that becomes sticky, because you then may limit people who don't have the financial wherewithal to access. So it's a challenge that the medical community would be faced with here in the years ahead.
Well, that actually leads really well into our next question about if patients can't speak to a doctor or they can't get that information quickly, how often do friends or family members send you pictures of their rashes or moles or something odd on their body, skin? And have you ever misdiagnosed any of these based off the picture?
Well, yeah, I will say that, I come from a big family and have friends from many pockets over the years. I get a few a month. I won't say I'm inundated by friends and family. But in the world of dermatology, when you have some of these eruptions, realize when we're in the office and someone has an eruption that's scaling, there's a mantra, when it scales, scrape it, because many times we're tricked by fungus infections, for example. But you can't tell whether it's a fungus at the time unless you scrape it and find it in a microscope, which we can do and very quickly in the dermatology clinic. But when people send you these images of rashes that have some scaling, occasionally you say it certainly could be XYZ, but fungus is the differential diagnosis and they just wanted the answer. And I occasionally have been wrong in that regard, which goes back to, again, when you see them in person, we're able to do that fungal scraping. But the difference between it's fungus or it's not fungus, if you give them something like a steroid and it's a fungal infection, you're going to make it worse. But yes, to answer your question, I've been wrong in that regard.
I think that's what I'm looking forward to the most, is just getting the random questions from family. Just ask. I've already had it and I'm only a second year med student. And I say, I don't know anything, mom and dad. I know the bare minimum.
Well, I will tell you, I'm glad. I will pause for a second. And I tell the residents this all the time, is the curbside consults that you get from your family and friends, you have to buck up for a second, admit when you're not sure, and make sure they get appropriate care, because you'll be amazed, however flippant the setting is. You could be at a high school reunion out with friends, and they ask you a quick question. To them, that's a formal medical opinion, no matter how relaxed the setting may be. So at some degree, you've got to capture yourself and realize, you know, I'm not sure right now, but make sure you get checked up here by your primary care doctor, because you'd be amazed at some of the flippant medical advice that's been given over the years that people took as the gospel, and it was not meant to be a formal medical evaluation. So we always want to help our friends and family, but there's nuance to that.
That's my favorite comment. Go check in with your PCP.
There you go.
Refer to PCP.
and God bless them. There's so many good people out there.
Absolutely. So our last question for today, Dr. Pearson, we know that you wrote an essay called Memorial Day Milepost that was in the New York Times. So can you explain to our viewers how running, the loss of a friend in combat, and Vermont are all related?
So I was a child. My dad was a big runner and had run marathons before it was popular. So I'd done it all along, but then got busy with family and work details. But you know, the culture in the military is that you're running to pass your physical fitness tests, but which would always do. And again, goes back to I did it for my mental health's sake. But for a window of time, when I was stationed at West Point, there was a group of us physicians at the hospital who got together to go for some long runs. And we decided to do a run called the Army 10 Miler at the Pentagon, which is one of the bigger runs in the country. But in any event, one of the five of us, his name was Brian Allgood, was an orthopedic surgeon who happened to just be the commander of our hospital also. And an easygoing guy and a very good runner. But we had a good time, and it was just some dedicated time for the five of us to be together and go for some runs. We did the Army 10 Miler. It was a great time. As it turned out, the night before the race, Brian and I got separated with regards to our plans. I mean, the two of us had dinner that night before at the Pentagon, and then would see each other at meetings periodically, even after he had left West Point and I was still there. When I saw Brian before he went to Iraq, would make small talk. You know, at that point in time, it was quite dangerous driving in Iraq because of the roadside bombs and so forth, and people were getting injured or killed in that way. And I talked to him about making sure that when you have the option to fly from point A to point B, but unfortunately he did fly from point A to point B, and a missile shot down their helicopter, and he was killed in Iraq. So Brian, now a clinic at West Point is named after him. The Army Hospital in Korea is named after my friend Brian Allgood. But in the months after that happened, I had not done any real long, hard distance running for years and years after at that point. But after that happened, I just started running a great deal more and saw that there was a marathon in Vermont. And I'd never been to Burlington before, but I came up. And it wasn't done specifically because it was Memorial Day weekend, but before that race started, they had played the national anthem. It was just one of the more poignant moments of my life at that point in time. Reflecting on Brian, it was quite emotional. But any of us who knew him, he was just the quiet type of leader who certainly if he'd not been killed in Iraq, perhaps where became the Surgeon General of the Army. He was so well respected. But that's when I fell in love with Vermont during that tough emotional time back about 15 years ago. Wrote an essay about him at another tour when I was in Afghanistan, and that was written. And then when I finished my military time, sure enough, there was a position here in Vermont, and that's why I ended up here. But that is it. And every year around Memorial time, I reflect on him. And many times when I'm out for a long run, I certainly think of him also.
Thanks so much for sharing. And that's a very touching story. And I'm glad that he led you here.
He was a good guy. But we love Vermont, and I've been very, very fortunate to be here.
My last question for you, Dr. Pearson, is what specifically made you want to teach and along with doing your clinical? Because I saw that you do 50% academic as well, or it's like about half and half where you're doing clinical and then you're doing teaching. And what about teaching do you love?
Oh, I just like the notion of giving back. I think many of us feel rejuvenated by all the young minds around us, and it's energizing. So just as in the military, when you're with the young troops that you developed a nice relationship with, certainly the students and the residents who come through, they're energizing. And so anyway, it's that sense of giving back and being to continue challenging us as clinicians. I think it does make you a better clinician to be around trainees. And it's very gratifying in that regard.
I think that seems to be the theme of who you are. It's very much so devoted to giving back. And, you know, you have all these gifts and you have all these skills and you have all these talents. And it's you wanting to share that with other people and help other people grow, which is really nice.
I don't know if I have any talents, but...
Speaking to people, you really can absorb a room, and like everyone is focused and listening to what you have to say. So you can really claim a room, and that's a talent.
Yeah. Well, thanks for saying that. It's just, you guys aren't sure the old guy's going to finish his sentences. That's all. But I appreciate the time with you today.
Yeah. Thank you so much for speaking with us today. We really appreciated you sharing your story and and being quite vulnerable with us. So it's been a great pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Haley, and thanks, Katie.
All right, folks, if you're still here, thanks for sticking with us. That's it for today on Green Mountain Medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our discussion, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @ACP_Vermont for more podcast updates, or subscribe to us on YouTube at Green Mountain Medicine.